Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Michael Duchenne, Director of Programming at Perimeter Institute. Welcome to the Mike Lazaridis Theater of Ideas on this cold morning. Going to be tough for those kids out in that tent today. We're very pleased to welcome Robert Friedel here this morning. Robert Friedel is Professor of History of Technology, History of Science, and Environmental History at the University of Maryland. He received his PhD from the Johns Hopkins University. Professor Friedel has written extensively on the nature of invention and has published numerous articles on material culture, as well as on the history of technology, ranging from the history of materials to changes in the engineering profession. Prior to joining the University of Maryland, he was a historian at the Smithsonian Institution and at the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers. He continues extensive work with museums, consulting, and collaborating on a range of projects for museums and agencies in Calcutta, Delhi, Stockholm, Munich, Pittsburgh, and Washington. His museum exhibits include A Material World at the National Museum of American History and Breaking Through, the Creative Engineer for the National Building Museum. He is active in the Society for the History of Technology and has been a contributing editor for American Heritage of Invention and Technology since 1985 and an advisory editor for Technology and Culture since 1993. He has held fellowships at the Smithsonian, the American Antiquarian Society, and the Dibner Institute for the History of Science and Technology. We're delighted to have him with us this morning. Please welcome Robert Friedel.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I should first say that I want to point out that much of what I'm going to be talking about today, which is about technology and invention around the year 1905, it's beautifully illustrated by the exhibit that you have out in the Institute itself. So if you haven't taken the time to go out, look at the artifact, look at some of the images and the like, it's actually very nicely done. In some ways, what I'm doing here is a little bit redundant, but I'll try to make it as relevant as I can. When Albert Einstein took up his job at the Swiss Patent Office in the summer of 1902, it was actually a pretty old-fashioned place. It didn't even have its own quarters. It was upstairs in this building on the corner of Berne, which is actually the Federal Telegraph building. And while the United States and many other countries had long dropped the requirement for applications to be accompanied by models, by physical models, the Swiss still had the requirement until 1908. And therefore, one gets the sense that the offices of the patent office were, in fact, perhaps a little bit messy. Now, the fact is, perhaps the young Einstein death may not have been quite so messy because, in fact, one suspects that the well-trained physicist, and at this point he had just received his PhD from the University of Zurich, that the well-trained physicist was given had been given mostly electrical topic to deal with because, in fact, he acknowledged himself later on in his life that he was actually mechanically a bit of a klutz. This sort of fits with our basic image of Einstein, I think, actually. Indeed, one legend in the Swiss Patent Office was that Einstein got his job because he was the only applicant for the position that understood Maxwell's equations. Now, this would hardly, in 1902, in fact, have been a terribly important criterion for a patent office examiner, but it does suggest the degree to which Einstein may have owed his position to at least a theoretical knowledge of the most promising of physical phenomena. Now, the Swiss Patent Office may have been a little bit of a backwater, but the fact is that patent offices of this day, the patent offices in large industrial countries such as Germany, France, Great Britain, and the United States, and this illustrates the U.S. Patent Office, which at this time was, I believe, still the largest office building in Washington, D.C., although it may have been exceeded by this time by the executive office building next to the White House. These were pretty active places. The first years of the 20th century were widely perceived as a time of rapid and profound technological change. Now, when I talk about rapid technological change, I don't want to give you the idea that this is all important stuff, it's big machines and that sort of thing, which is what I'm going to be talking about, I have to admit. But if you look for the patent of 1905, you'll see a nice variety of the sorts of things. We heard a talk last night, for example, about fashion in 1905, and we can see that, in fact, this is the transition point when the corset, and you'd be amazed at the number of corset patents that you find throughout the last decades of the 19th century. The corset patents are still being applied for. And then rather equally fun, I think, are the patents that you find for toys. I believe that this is, in fact, a fairly recognizable puzzle. This is one of those wooden puzzles where you put the pieces together and you try to figure out how they come apart, that sort of thing. That, too, deserves a patent. And as I said, this is the kind of thing that you will find in the patent file for 1905. Now, the fact is that people at this time really did have a marvelous sense of change, of profound technological change taking place at all sorts of levels. And I want to start off having given you that little bit of a sense of one level of patent activity. I want to start off here now with something a little bit more profound and complex. The changes at the beginning of the 20th century were remarked on in a variety of ways. To the historian, certainly to the American historian, one of the most interesting commentaries on this change came, naturally, from another historian. Henry Adams, whom you see here, was the great-grandson and the grandson of U.S. presidents, the product of a privileged upbringing and of a Harvard education. And he was an unusually wide-ranging scholar. His historical works went from a multi-volume history of U.S. diplomacy to a study of medieval French architecture, a range which, by the way, no history professor today could get away with. His most famous book, however, was not his history books, at least what we remember him for now. It was a memoir published the year of his death in 1918. In The Education of Henry Adams, which he entitled his memoir, I thought it's quite quirky because he writes about himself in the third person, which is often a little odd. Henry Adams remarked on the transformation in his own worldview that resulted from exposure to the new technologies at the turn of the century. The pivotal moment for him, as he describes it in his book, came as he toured the great gallery of machines at the Paris World Fair of 1900. Accompanied by one of his scientist friends, Samuel Langley. Now, the picture, the building that you see here was a building built for the World Fair of 1900. It is, in fact, the Palace of Electricity, surrounded also with what was typical. You'll see the same thing happening in the World Fair of Chicago of 1893, surrounded by lighted fountains. It's really quite the sort of the classy image of a day. But what Adams was doing is he was being toured around the fair by a scientific expert. Adams was one of the Washington, D.C. intelligentsia. And part of his circle included this man, Samuel Langley, who was the head of a Smithsonian institution. Now, Langley was already famous in his day for his experiments on flying machines. Now, when we think of Langley and flying machines, unfortunately, we don't think of success, but rather we think of failure. This is one of the famous images of one of Langley's aerodromes taking what seemed to be almost the inevitable dip into the Potomac River as they attempted to set off. But in 1900, failure was not yet attached to Samuel Langley's name, and his experiments on flying machines were, in fact, quite well known and quite noted. And his friend, Henry Adams, was, of course, very happy to go along with him. And he explained, in fact, that what Langley is doing at the World Fair is to take him around to show him, in fact, the new motors that might be used for the aerodrome that he's trying to build. This, by the way, is the first Mercedes. Comes out about 1900, 1901. This is the sort of thing that, in fact, Langley would have been looking for. It's interesting, by the way, I should note that in Peter Jacobs' lecture yesterday, he points out that, in fact, the Wright brothers were not that really worried about the motors, about the power plant of their airplane, they quite rightly focused on the aerodynamic, not only of the plane itself, but of the propulsion system itself. Another hint at some of the wrong directions that Langley might have been following, but I digress. What Langley is doing is he's taking his friend through the gallery of machines. And Adams explained Langley's interest. His chief interest was in new motors to make his airship feasible. And he taught Adams, remember, he's talking about himself in the third person, he taught Adams the astonishing complexities of the new Daimler and of the automobile, which since 1893 had become a nightmare at 100 kilometers per hour, almost as destructive as the electric tram, which was only 10 years older, and threatening to become as terrible as the locomotive steam engine itself, which was almost exactly Adams' own age. Adams, by the way, was born in 1838. But the most astonishing thing to Adams were not the motors and the automobile, but the gigantic sources of power for the lights and the electric machines scattered throughout the fairgrounds at the base of the Eiffel Tower. The Eiffel Tower, you may recall, had been built for the 1889 World Fair. And in fact, the buildings, this building, the Hall of Machines for the 1900 World Fair, was recycled from the 1889 World Fair. Now, the scene that is described by Langley is, in fact, worth quoting at length. So if you will allow me a quotation. "Then he," Langley, "showed his scholar the great hall of dynamos, and explained how little he knew about electricity or force of any kind, even of his own special sun, which spouted heat in inconceivable volume, but which, as far as he knew, might spout less or more at any time for all the certainty he felt in it. To him, the dynamo itself was but an ingenious channel for conveying somewhere the heat latent in a few tons of poor coal hidden in a dirty engine house, carefully kept out of sight. But for Adams, the dynamo became a symbol of infinity. As he grew accustomed to the great gallery of machines, he began to feel the 40-foot dynamos as a moral force, much as the early Christian felt the cross. The planet itself seemed less impressive in its old-fashioned, deliberate, annual or daily revolution, then this huge wheel, revolving within arm's length at some vertiginous speed and barely murmuring, scarcely humming an audible warning to stand a hair's breadth further for respective power, while it could not wake the baby lying close against its frame. Before the end, one began to pray to it. Inherited instinct taught the natural expression of man before silent and infinite force." Now, most notably, Adams went on to compare the meaning of the dynamos he saw for 20th century Americans and Europeans to that of the Virgin Mary for the medieval Christian that he was accustomed to studying. This is the nave of Chartres Cathedral, and one of Adams' most famous books was about Chartres and about the reverence for the Virgin Mary. And in fact, Adams entitles the chapter of his education, "The Dynamo and the Virgin." Now, I quote Adams here because we want to grasp the sense of change, and in particular, the sense of dislocation that technological change conveyed to people at the beginning of the 20th century. It was, I would argue, at least as disorienting and wonderful as the sense of change that we appreciate in our own day. Now, what we want to do now is we want to figure out, well, what were these changes, and what were people looking at, and what were people paying attention to and reacting to? And the kind of changes, the kind of things that folk were focusing on 100 years ago were a mixture of the predictable and the surprising. So if we turn to get a sense of what people are looking at, to the pages of America's most popular scientific magazine, Scientific American, to get a sense of a particular sources of fascination, we get some interesting images. 100 years ago this week, the issue of October 7th, 1905, Scientific American, by the way, was a weekly in those days that it had been for many decades through the second half of the 19th century. The magazine's cover story was in fact about the qualifying races for the most prestigious American automobile race of the day, the Vanderbilt Cup. A 60-horsepower Pope Toledo, which is what you see here, won the qualifier, that is the qualifying races for the Cup, which was to come a little bit later that month, with an average speed of just under 49 miles per hour. Automobile stories were common in 1905, popular technology magazines, as computer and internet stories were in those of the 1990s. Now, other items in our issue of Scientific American discuss the ongoing debate about the building of a canal across Panama. Some still argued, by the way, you'll notice this is a cover story on the canal, and you'll see that, in fact, the canal canal route had been approved by President Roosevelt. You can read the plan over here. In the 1905 issue, there's actually still a debate about whether there should be a sea level canal across Panama, or in fact, should it be a summit level route? And if it's a summit level route, which you say, are you going to have locks that take you up a level and then locks that take you back down to the Pacific level, how high should it go? Which is actually a pretty major issue. The same October 7th issue also had a story about wireless experimenters trying to solve the problem of selectivity. That is, how do you direct the radio transmission so that it would only be received by those who wanted to receive it? This is actually a pretty big problem in that day. It's the problem of tuning and also the problem of directionality. People simply did not know what this new technology was going to be. These are the kind of ad, by the way, that appeared in Scientific American in those days, showing that, in fact, you could have possibly buy the equipment for a basic wireless telegraph system. Now, notice, if you look carefully, you'll notice that, in fact, that this particular system has absolutely no provision for tuning whatsoever. And that is, in fact, one of the things that were plaguing wireless experiments in those days, is that, in fact, most of the circuits weren't tuned. And so, in fact, if you had more than one wireless experimenter somewhere in the neighborhood at any one time, they were constantly interfering with one another. This is sort of the stage of that technology at this point. Now, another topic of similar fascination, but receiving a rather different kind of attention from Scientific American, was the topic of flying machines. Now, airplane designs and balloons and dirigibles and all that sort of thing of every variety were described, often in great detail. To many, heavier than air flight appeared to be only a matter of time and effort before it becoming real. Of course, to our mind, in 1905, this might seem a little odd, since we all know that the dream of heavier-than-air flight had, in fact, been achieved a year or so earlier by two bicycle mechanics from Dayton, Ohio, flying on the dunes of Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. However, in 1905, the Scientific American had this to say of the Wright brothers and of reports that they had heard of their successful flight. If, Scientific American goes on to say, if such sensational and tremendously important experiment were being conducted in a not very remote part of the country, which you could say Dayton, Ohio, on a subject in which almost everybody feels the most profound interest, is it possible to believe that the enterprising American reporter who, it is well known, comes down the chimney when the door is locked in his face, even if he had to scale a 15-story skyscraper to do so, would not have ascertained all about them, the Wright brothers, and published them broadcast long ago? Well, the Wright brothers are still toiling away in Dayton. They're flying their experimental craft on Huffman Prairie. So, in fact, the Wright brothers continue to be ignored, and it's not until 1908 when, in fact, the Wrights had gone to Europe to demonstrate their flyer to growing audiences before the truth dawned that the flying machine was indeed real. Now, the revolutions of transport on land and on the air are part of our historical image of the last century beginning. But just as striking to observers at the time, and in fact, more striking in many ways if the evidence of the magazines and the newspapers is clear, even though it's less evident to us, were the great changes in maritime technologies. This is an interesting commentary on how our entire mindset has changed. If you look at the kind of reportage that we have on technological change, on what's exciting, what's big, what shows the way to the future around 1900, you have to look to the sea. a place where, in fact, we do not expect to see much, at least terribly exciting or cutting-edge change. The great naval buildup that had been going on for about two decades continued to fascinate observers. But in 1905, it was about to enter a new phase. This, by the way, depicts a visit of one of the latest of the British warships to New York Harbor. Up to this point, 1905, ships with steel plate and large guns continued an evolutionary change. You will recall that just a little bit more than a decade before, the U.S. battleship Maine had blown up in Havana Harbor, setting off the Spanish-American War. And this was typical. The Maine, an ironclad, heavily gunned vessel, were typical of what navies around the world were equipping themselves with from the 1880s and the 1890s. The Russians and the Japanese showed off their version of these as they went to war, in a very ugly war in the Far East, culminating at sea in a shocking Japanese victory. This is the Japanese fleet that you see here at Tsushima Straits in May of 1905. So you can imagine that in the summer and fall of 1905, people are still abuzz about the powers at sea and what is being unleashed. But at the end of 1905, the rules and the technology of sea warfare were about to change. In the British naval shipyard at Portsmouth, on the south coast of England, construction began late 1905 on a new ship, the HMS Dreadnought, that so far exceeded the capabilities of anything ever before attempted, that it forced a long and costly naval arms race on the European powers that only fueled the likelihood of war that, in fact, did break out in 1914. The armament on the Dreadnought surpassed anything that had ever been seen before. 10 12-inch guns, supplemented by 24 3-inch guns and 5 torpedo tubes. In addition, this was the first large battleship powered by steam turbine, almost 25,000 horsepower and reaching 21 knots, far exceeding what older ships could do. Now, these may all seem relatively trivial in an age of missiles and satellites and electronic warfare, but the technology observers of 1905 were keenly aware that, at least in the short run, these maritime developments were rewriting not just the rules of war, but the basic geopolitical and economic calculus of the great powers. Now, what I mean by that is simply that building ships like this was about to bankrupt the powers of Europe because they were so expensive, and yet everybody felt that they had to keep up with them. Now, ships were not the only things that were getting larger in 1905. Electric power that had been introduced barely 20 years before in the first Edison power stations that supplied light to maybe a square mile, if that, were now getting gigantic. The real attention grabbers were the gigantic turbines at Niagara Falls. On both the American and the Canadian sides, the huge electric generating plants that still define the area around Niagara for many of us were taking shape, becoming a model for the future shape by plentiful and omnipresent electric power. These, by the way, these generators, which are, you see being put into one of the stations, I believe on the American side, just to give you the sense of scale of these machines. Now, speaking of large scale and speaking of Canada, I have to mention one other technology that, in fact, is quite notable and people are commenting on in the 1905 issues of Scientific American, and that is the most ambitious bridge project of the day, the bridge over the St. Lawrence at Quebec. Of course, the magazine's writers had no way of knowing that just a year later, now this picture shows you the finished bridge. I wanted you to know exactly what bridge I was talking about. The bridge has finished in 1917, but in 1906, this, unfortunately, is what the bridge over at Quebec looked like. It crashed down into the river at the cost of 82 workers' lives. When the bridge was finally completed, after yet one more major mishap in 1916, it boasted the largest single span of any bridge in the world. Now, when we ourselves look back on the technologies of 1905, however, I don't think that it is size that catches our eye, but truly giant technologies of the 20th century. After all, the Boulder Dams and the Golden Gate Bridges and the Soviet Thiel complexes and the giant rocket facilities were yet to come well on into the century. We're more likely to notice in the historical glass at the beginning of the 20th century the hints, sometimes faint and sometimes more apparent, of technology just being born. Some of them technologies of great importance, and some of them rather minor in the grand scheme of things, and yet still worthy of notice. Now, the 19th century had been particularly notable for the way in which humans had finally transcended the truly ancient boundaries of space and time. The railroad and the telegraph, in particular, had demolished the limits on the movements of both people and goods, and on the communication of news, information, and the mundane chit-chat of daily life. Toward the century's end, these achievements were moving from the social and the collective scale of the railroad and the telegraph to the intimate and personal scale of the bicycle, the automobile, and the telephone. The particular process was just getting going in the first years of the 20th century. Now, as we saw from our look at Scientific American, the automobile was a source of widespread fascination. An article appeared continually from the middle of the 1890s all the way for at least a couple of more decades, describing new models, new trials, new races. It's a little surprising when we look back and we think of the automobile as a commodity, we think of the automobile as an instrument of personal transportation, as the key element of the way that cities are organized, that in fact the way the automobile is being looked at here is, if you are to take the newspapers and the magazine most literally, is as much as anything else as a racing machine, as a sporting machine. There's a little bit of a hint of earlier possibilities. At this point in 1905, Henry Ford is still organizing his Ford Motor Company, and it's still just trying to work out exactly what the Ford Motor Company is going to be doing. This is Ford riding his first car, his quadricycle. Fairly crude, simple little device. He actually, by 1905, is making some pretty good cars, but they're very expensive still. The Model T, that of course is going to transform everything, is still 3 years into the future at this point. And the assembly line that actually made it possible to effect the revolution that it did is in fact a full decade away. The very idea of technology liberating personal transportation, however, had in fact been something that had been around for a while. The bicycle, the safety bicycle, was introduced in the 1870s, and the two-wheeler had, in fact, appreciated and enjoyed a number of crazes through the course of the second half or the last quarter of the 19th century. Now, the bicycle was still considered a technology worthy of development and attention. Witness the attraction that it had for those two young mechanics in Dayton, Ohio, who eventually decided that flying machines were even more alluring. But in 1905, it wasn't even clear just what the future of the automobile would be. The internal combustion engine, which had been introduced by Benz and Daimler back in the 1880s, this is the first Daimler. You can see it has only three wheels, so again, it's pure, obviously a very experimental device. With being rivaled still at that time by steam cars, this is a Stanley steamer out in the west making its way, and by electric cars as well. And there was still a very substantial competition, which is not going to be settled for at least another decade among the possibilities of internal combustion, steam, and electricity. Already by 1905, however, the automobile beginning to move into a larger realm of culture itself. And the first inexpensive cars are not terribly successful, mainly because they're not very good cars, but they're inexpensive, they're accessible. And so they are, in fact, beginning to make an impact on the way that people think about the world. The Oldsmobile, the Ransom Olds, is a good example of a car which was not bad, but it's certainly no Model T. But again, it brought the cost of the automobile down. It brought the numbers being manufactured up into more than a dozen and hundreds and actually into the thousands. But this is still a revolution that is still aborning in 1905. Now, another area where we can see just the beginnings of change is in communication. And we begin to see the possibilities of communication on both the personal level and on a larger level. As a practical instrument, the telephone was barely 20 years old, and it was still very much a city instrument, often seen as a businessman's tool. In fact, if you think about the telephone in 1905, you're better off having the image of a fax machine rather than the telephone, the ubiquitous talk anytime you want to whomever you want sort of thing. It was the kind of thing that connected people who had to get some kind of information from one place to another place. But the idea of sociability, the idea of a telephone as a kind of intimate instrument, is just beginning to be formed in 1905. Furthermore, the possibilities of distance with the telephone are, too, just beginning to be established. This is Alexander Graham Bell inaugurating long-distance service between New York and Chicago in 1896. This is still and the first transcontinental transmission still hasn't taken place yet. So we can see that we have the telephone. Still not quite the omnipresent sort of thing, the universal instrument that we think of today. One of the reasons is that telegram was still considered to be quite adequate for the purpose. If you wanted to get a message from one place to another place, you sent a telegram. It worked in the middle of the 19th century. It worked in the late 19th century. The idea that we needed something to transcend the telegram, the telegraph system, was in fact not that obvious. Now, I point that out because, of course, there is another important kind of communication system that people are beginning to look at this point, and that is what we call wireless. Now, the idea of wireless, the idea of electrical communication over distance without wires, was, in fact, decades old. Thomas Edison himself, who started off as a telegrapher, claimed to have invented a workable system of inductive telegraphy. And there were a number of systems like this. This is actually a system by one of Edison's assistants, Granville T. Woods, one of the first African-American inventors that we have a good record of. And this is the patent for the inductive telegraph system that he devised in the 1880s. What it is that the idea is to solve the problem of how do you, in fact, communicate between a moving train and another train or a stationary station. And this was the kind of thing that people wanted to solve. And they came up with these ideas of using kind of the inductive effect of electricity. And none of them worked very well. It was a plausible idea. But in fact, it's not until we get people using a very different kind of electric signaling that we begin to get change. And that, of course, is the work that we associate most intimately with an Italian by the name of Guglielmo Marconi. Now, through the 1890s, Marconi had, in fact, been experimenting. He had caught whiff of the idea of wireless communication. Heinrich Hertz, in the middle of the 1880s, had demonstrated the Hertzian waves, radio waves, that we would call them. And Marconi was basically a very enthusiastic, very well-read, and fortunately, fairly rich amateur who could, in fact, pursue these experiments on his own to try to extend the distance that these radio waves could, in fact, be detected. When Hertz showed these radio waves off in the 1880s, the distances that we're talking about were in terms of a meter, or 2 meters, or 3 meters. But Marconi wanted to make this into a real communication system. After several years of trying, he claimed to have received signals at Signal Hill at St. John's, Newfoundland, at the end of 1901. I say claim because there's been some debate among historians about whether that SOS from the station in Cornwall on the west coast of England had in fact been received. But the fact is that within months of that claim reception, it was quite clear that in fact Marconi was able to engage in transatlantic wireless communication. Now, the fact is that when these things are being done, there were still a lot of problems that had to be solved. Just what wireless communication would in fact mean in the future was something that people were still in fact experimenting with. And that's because in 1905, we're still lacking the key elements of what would make a wireless system practical. This is what a Marconi station looks like. This is actually the station in the Titanic in 1912. It hadn't changed a whole lot, except that the introduction of the valve or diode by Alexander Fleming in 1906 gave the radio receiver the first kind of really reliable detector. And of course, this later on in the decade turned into the triode, thanks to the work of Lee DeFari, and the radio makers finally have an amplifier that they can use. In addition, right about this time, 1905 is too early, but if we look at 1906, we see the first experiments by Reginald Fessenden in voice transmission. There's a nice little picture of this out in your exhibit there. He's at Brant Rock in a station on the east coast of Massachusetts, and he startled everybody by getting out there with a microphone, a phonograph. And on Christmas Eve of 1906, he began playing music. And you've got these Marconi ship receivers, people in their Marconi rooms aboard ship, and they're listening for dots and dashes. And all of a sudden, they start hearing jingle bells. You can imagine it was a pretty startling moment. But it was largely a stunt. But 1905 does represent the point at which we can really see radio in the midst of that transition. For example, that is the year that the SOS signal is first adopted by German wireless operators as a distress call. Up to this point, and for a few years afterward, there's still a question about whether you use CDQ or some other system, but SOS makes its first appearance in 1905. Now, possibilities of sort of mysterious black box electric and electronic technologies is something, too, that we should associate with the beginning of the 20th century. 10 years before 1905, in 1895, another German physicist by the name of Wilhelm Röntgen stumbled across one of the most startling discoveries of the 19th century, and that is X-rays. This is a wonderful, one of the most historic photographs that you'll find. This is the photograph that Röntgen, or the radiograph, we would say, that Röntgen took of his wife's hand. And this is published in his article announcing the X-ray in 1895, and you can see the wedding band on her ring finger very clearly shown. Now, what's interesting is, the X-ray episode tells us one other thing that we're beginning to get a sense of about technology and its reception at this period, and that is people get very excited about it, and people attempt to exploit it in whatever way that they can. So we, in fact, begin to get the development of X-ray machines, of X-ray, of the kind of apparatus that, in fact, is actually often quite dangerous. And in fact, it's not for a few years yet that people begin to realize that overexposure to X-rays is going to be a real problem. Because people get very excited about these technologies. And they're difficult technologies to understand at one level, but at another level, they're not difficult technology to pursue. This is not high capital. You can get yourself some X-ray equipment. You can get yourself some radio equipment. You can experiment. You can exploit. It's not unlike the internet was in 1990. You know, set yourself up, get a domain name, come up with some ideas about how to use it. And so we have this kind of technological excitement and sense of exploitation at the beginning of the century. Now, one other medium that I should need to make mention is, in fact, and something else, the direction of which is beginning to get a little bit clearer by 1905, is, of course, motion pictures. The first motion picture came from experiments in the mid-19th century with optical illusions and persistence of vision. By about 1890, the availability of a transparent film, the first plastic celluloid, for photography drew a range of experimenters into the development of moving images for entertainment. Thomas Edison developed his kinetoscope, a kind of peep show, in the 1890s. And the Lumiere brothers introduced the first successful projector in 1895. And over the next 10 years, cinematography, and now we're beginning to adopt the terminology of the Lumiere brothers, cinematography spread rapidly. But it was largely limited to one-minute reel, just sort of brief experience. You've got some wonderful examples out there in the exhibit. Take a look at some of those early film shots. They give you a sense of what film meant in those first years. But we are beginning to go beyond that a little bit level. The Great Train Robbery came in 1903 to show what a story on film might look like, something that actually happened, a constructed story. And in 1905, the first film in Britain, Rescue by Rover, comes out. Everybody knows about The Great Train Robbery, but Rescue by Rover, I'd really like to see it one of these days. It looks very intriguing from the shot that I found. For the next decade, the 10 to 15-minute reel became the staple of what we're coming to call cinema. Attendance was spurred by the creation in 1905 of the Nickelodeon, which gave access to the new entertainment for 5 cents a seat. By 1910, it was estimated that 26 million people in the United States, out of a total population of 92 million, saw at least one movie a week. That's an absolutely astonishing statistic to me. The future, feature-length films, sound, color, were all over the horizon, but people were clearly looking for them. And even at this relatively primitive level, cinema was the miracle of the age. Now, it would be misleading for us to think of technology only in terms of the grand and significant and obviously important kind of technologies. Just as now, a century ago, change was looked for and found on all sorts of levels. So I wish to end my discussion here by one of my favorite examples of this. In 1905, there was an obscure company in Hoboken, New Jersey. Now, this actually is an earlier version of this company around 1902. At that point, it was called the Fafner Manufacturing and Machine Company. In 1905, it had changed its name to the Automatic Hook and Eye Company. And in that year, it brought its first substantial product to market. This, the so-called Security Fastener. Now, it's an odd little device, but I trust you can take, even by looking at it here, it's not much imagination if required to recognize it's the progenitor of the ubiquitous zipper. It's actually not the first version of this so-called automatic fastener, nor obviously not the last. But the Security was the first one that salesmen were able to palm off on the unsuspecting buyers in any numbers. Now, I put it that way because it quickly became clear that this was actually a very bad fastener. It stuck when it was supposed to slide open. It came open when it was supposed to stay shut. And it broke or rusted just after one washing. In fact, I found some of the early packaging, which tells you that if you have put the fastener into a garment, be sure to remove it from the garment before you wash it. Few, if any, people bought more than one. But simply the pursuit of this device, the promise of the automatic coming to something, to mean something real, something modern, something 20th century. It's testimony to the early 20th century fascination with novelty, machinery, and technology. It actually took another decade of work to make the modern zipper, and I have to comment on the fact, particularly after hearing Peter Jacob talk on the airplane yesterday, it's always been very striking to me that it took longer to figure out how to make a successful zipper than it took for the Wright brothers to figure out how to make an airplane. This, in fact, is a device that is not developed until 1913, and it is introduced in 1915 as the hookless fastener. Although I have to point out that the first term that had been suggested by the makers of this device was the hookless hooker. I think we should be happy that they changed that. The term zipper, by the way, came in the 1920s. Now, the new name, the hookless, echoed the association with the fantastic technologies of the day. It joined the wireless and the horseless and the other elements in the promises of a future without limits. And in a curious way, this actually allowed me to come back to our Swiss Patent Office. If you look in the Swiss patents, this is actually issued in 1911. Albert Einstein had left by 1909, so he never would have seen this. This precedes the 1913-1914 patents that you just saw before. It is taken out by a woman by the name of Katharina Kuhn-Muss, and it's considered to be the most likely real progenitor of the zipper as we know it. And in fact, it was the subject of great patent litigation in the 1920s as people tried to attack the basic patent of a zipper. I might add, for technical reasons, which I'll be glad to go into, anybody cares to know as to why this particular zipper doesn't work. But it is, again, it does bring me back to the Swiss Patent Office. And in a sense, it is with this vision of a limitless future, the hookless, the wireless, the horseless, that is the most appropriate place to end our story. Einstein's papers of 1905, particularly his theory of special relativity, were about removing limits on the way in which we perceive the universe, dispensing with the boundaries of absolute space and absolute time. The 20th century would continue to be a period in which the boundaries of science and of technology were transcended over and over again. Thank you.
We have time for a few questions. I'd ask you to raise your hand and somebody will bring you a microphone, and please stand up and speak clearly. Any takers?
Your zipper work, we have to ask.
The device you should be able to see here, maybe you can't. Take a look at, well, if you can, take a look at the zipper. And you'll, some of you can do this more easily than others. And you'll notice that the little nibs on the zipper are not round. These are round, okay? And if they're not round, and that means that the zipper cannot hinge like this, okay? Cannot bend. But this is actually like a piano hinge, in a sense. In other words, the zipper, in fact, is not stable in that particular dimension. So the two sides of the zipper can swivel like that. And when they swivel like this, they'll pop open like this, you see. Okay, they have to remain like this. And so the design that you and I enjoy today, which is in fact the design that Gideon Sumback patented in 1913, is not with rounded nib, but in fact with oblong or rectangular nib, and that prevents that swivel effect. I know you were all fascinating to hear that.
Other questions?
Can you comment on the World Fairs, where they originated, and how they helped to promote the popular understanding and growth of technology into culture?
That's a big question. I'll just answer just very briefly in this context. The World Fairs from the middle of the 19th century have been really key places to expose people to the latest technologies of the day. And there's a wonderful history of how the World Fairs acted as a means for transcending the limitations of locality in terms of technological knowledge. For example, the American system of manufacture and the idea of using interchangeable parts is something that the British come to appreciate through the American displays at the Crystal Palace of 1851. Well, similarly, Charles Goodyear's inventions of rubber were exposed to the world in that same Crystal Palace exhibit. So throughout the second half of the 19th century and on into the first decade or so of the, at least up to World War I, we have a wonderful series of world fairs, each one of which is in fact shows off the latest technology of the day, and people would come, they would look at what there was, they would buy samples, and they would go back. So it was the indispensable mechanism of, in fact, getting technological information out, and I should add, of giving it a kind of spectacle nature. These were technological spectaculars. This is the way that you showed off the latest thing. Electricity, especially from the World Fair of the 1880s, became the kind of hallmark of what spectacular electricity is supposed to look like. The Chicago World Fair of 1893 was particularly noted for the amount of electric lighting that was scattered throughout it. And all the World Fairs after that had to show spectacular electrical lighting effects.
When did the sense of hazard in what people were doing with all this new technology sort of come into play? You touched on it with the X-ray, that people were doing things. They were able to readily get equipment and do things. When did they begin to realize that there was hazard attached to this? The dangers and things that are attached to, you know, for instance, X-rays. People were using X-rays to look at their feet and their chests and things like that. But was there a point at which people began to look at science and say, this is scary stuff?
I couldn't hear all the details of your question, but the very first, what pops into my mind is when the very first railroad was inaugurated in England in the 1820s, 1825, I think it was, a member of parliament was run over. So the idea that these, and one suspects that, you know, when the first telegraph line was being strung in the 1840s, somebody no doubt put a wire in the wrong place at the wrong time. Although the voltage was low enough, it probably wasn't fatal. But the fact is that people recognized very early on that any kind of new technology, new device had hazards and difficulties and posed challenges. What was interesting to me about the X-ray episode was the fact that the X-ray, if you stop and think about it, even before radio, the X-ray is the first technology that is totally, completely, absolutely mysterious to most of the people who are encountering it. I mean, completely beyond their comprehension as to what's going on. And it is quite magical. I mean, even today, I mean, look at an MRI scan of your body and tell me that you're not absolutely flabbergasted, okay? So, but this is a case where people are, they begin, at just at this point, they begin to accept amazement, if you will, in ways that people marveled at the technologies of the earlier 19th century. They marveled at the telegraph and the railroad and the telephone and the phonograph and the electric light. They did. They thought they were quite wonderful. But to have technologies that were just totally jaw-dropping in what they could do, that really began to transcend into the realm of magic. The X-ray, to me, would sort of set the stage for radio and for the other electronic technologies of the 20th century. It's a place where we begin to see that. And the fact that there were unknown hazards, the fact that, and of course, the discovery of X-ray coincides almost precisely with the discovery of radioactivity, which, too, is a great miracle, a great marvel, a great mystery and magic. Particularly when Marie Curie began to promote the exploitation of radium toward the end of the first decade of the 20th century. And then there, too, people are unaware initially of the enormous dangers and the enormous hazards that they're going to be faced with. So we end up with this very interesting mix of amazement and marvel and magic on the one hand, and danger and concern and worry and consternation and even paranoia on the other hand. And there have been historians that have done a wonderful job of tracing particularly how the story of the atom, the exploitation of, if you will, of Einstein E equals mc squared, comes to be associated with exactly that combination of marvel and magic on the one hand, and danger and fear on the other hand. And that's very integral to what happened to technology in the 20th century.
Just one question. For people who lived at around that time, 1905, if they were to think about the future, 2005, and knowing where we are today, do you think their reaction would be one of, yes, that's predictable, I would have thought that's where we should be by then, or would they say, you know, inconceivable science fiction, we would never be where we are today? And possibly as an extension to the question, in the next 100 years from now, do you think that it's possible that we will be, will the world be inconceivable from our own view today?
That's a really good question, if I understand it correctly. If I don't, I'll make up a really good question. It sounds like it. There are clearly points in history when, if you were to be Rip Van Winkle and you go to sleep and you wake up 40 years or 50 years hence, you would just have your head spin with a sense of change, a sense of vertigo, if you will. There is a degree to which I believe the people of 1905, the visitors of the Paris World Fair of 1900, the people going through the Byrne Patent Office, would not be overly surprised or shocked by the world that they would encounter 100 years later. So much of what I've tried to describe are the beginnings of technology that, in fact, are still very integral to our own day. There are all sorts of things that we consider to be quite marvelous ourselves. Our cellular telephone, for example, our computers and our internet, and all of that sort of thing. They are all quite marvelous. They're all quite wonderful. But I have to say that in my mind, I'm just not certain that the people of 1900, if they were really aware, if they were really on top of what was going on, if they were obviously very ready, for example, to accept the idea of a flying machine. That, you know, they're waiting for it. It's not going to come as a big surprise to them by this time. Exactly who's going to make it, and exactly what it's going to look like, and exactly how it's going to work, that's still to be seen. But the fact that there will be flying machines, the fact that there will be wireless communication, again, it's marvelous, it's wonderful, but it's not a really big surprise. So I think that there is a degree to which in those realms, the people 100 years ago would have in a sense been prepared in ways that their grandparents or great-grandparents would not have been prepared for the world that they lived in. There's one great area of change that I have only very elliptically alluded to here, not really alluded to at all, that would perhaps surprise someone 100 years ago, and it's where we might also look to the future, and that is in the technologies of life, of biology. The technologies of medicine in the 20th century did undergo radical, profound change. And the way that we look at mortality, the way that we look at disease, the way that we look at pain is, in fact, fundamentally different from it was the way it was 100 years ago. And when I'm asked to speculate, the first answer I have is I'm a historian. So one of the reasons I'm a historian, I don't worry about the future too much. But when I'm asked to speculate, and I throw caution to the wind, I think possibly that those realms of biology, of life, of the manipulation of genetic material, those are the areas where I suspect the surprises are going to come. And if I knew what they were, they wouldn't be surprises.
coming back to Einstein, do we have any evidence that he was visiting those world fairs? And how much do we believe that there was he plugged in to those technology advances?
Actually, I wondered that question myself when I was thinking about Paris in 1900. But Einstein doesn't appear to, I was in fact checking his biography just the other day. He doesn't appear to have been somebody who liked to travel just for that sort of thing. He read the newspaper quite clearly. He would have been aware of the sorts of things that were going on, but his position in the patent office, as I suggested at the beginning of my talk, is a little ironic in the sense that he really did, he said later that the patent office for him was very valuable for a couple of reasons. One is it forced him to think about language. We don't think about that in patent offices, but in patent offices, you have to make your descriptions clear. And you have to make them clear to an audience that is not an academic audience. You have to make them clear to a wide range of people. And so Einstein finds himself into a situation where he has to actually think about getting the inventors that are coming to the patent office to clarify their language. And the other thing that he said that the patent office did for him was that it gave him time to think about physics. That if he had become a professor right away, and anybody who has embarked on an academic career can appreciate this. If he had been made a professor right away, he would have been too busy trying to churn out the sorts of things that junior professors were supposed to churn out. He's a clerk in the patent office, so he can put in those papers to the Annalen of Physique and not worry about it, because his job at the patent office is still going to be there, regardless of what kind of reception those papers receive. So that's the kind of mentality he has. He's not out there trying to. He's certainly not out there trying to change the world or think about technology or anything of that sort, although he's certainly aware of the technologies around him.
Okay. Come on. Robert, it's been just great having you around the Institute for a couple of days. We look forward to your participation in Bistro Banter this afternoon, 4 o'clock, with Howard Burton, James Delgado, and Mike Lazaridis. Thanks, Howard. Thank you for a great lecture. Thank you for joining us this morning. The exit is at the top of the stairs to the right. Thank you.